We are beginning this morning a group of sermons on the Reformation movement, on how we got from Luther and Calvin, Zwingli and Knox, Henry VIII and Jonathan Edwards, to the congregational faith we profess in this place. A Reformation movement implies that something has gone wrong. So this opening sermon raises the question, how bad was the church by the 14th and 15th centuries? But honesty and fairness demand a moment first in which we confess how good it was most of the time and how enormous our debt is to the Catholic Church. It is not too much to claim that after the fall of the Roman Empire, her creed and ritual held people together for 1,000 years. Her monasteries fed the poor, educated young boys, had bread and breakfast for travelers. The church created hospitals, gave shelter in convents for women who would not or could not marry, and trained teachers, scholars, judges, and diplomats for centuries. There were careless and ignorant monks who allowed priceless manuscripts to perish, but there were many more who copied and kept them for all of us. The church built the universities, and the soaring poetry in stone that we call Gothic cathedrals, and inspired some of the greatest art and music in the Western world. It is almost impossible to overstate what we owe to the medieval church. But it is almost equally impossible to overstate how bad this church could be at times, and especially in the 200 years before her own priests and scholars declared that she must reform or perish. I grew up a Protestant, hearing about the titillating bacchanalian revelries of monks and nuns, but the truth is that the real issue was money, and the greed which is driven by money. After centuries of submission to the church, kings and emperors who needed to finance wars and capitalism began scheming to keep money away from Rome, while Rome, driven by necessity, feverishly devised new ways to get it, some of them so crass that other children of the church were deeply embarrassed. Let's talk for a moment about the 14th century, when the church really began to fall apart politically and morally. A French king managed to get a Frenchman elected as Pope, and then moved that Pope to Avignon, where for nearly 70 years it was obvious that the popes were no more than pawns and allies of France. Other countries lost interest in giving obedience and sending money to a holy see in France, so the French popes imposed greater and greater taxes. If they named a new bishop, he had to pay back half his first year's income. If a cardinal or an archbishop or an abbot died, his personal property reverted to the papal office. If one wanted a job or promotion, a gift was expected. It was a loyal Catholic bishop who wrote that within the bosom of the church, all men, from the greatest unto the least, have set their hearts upon covetousness. And it was a Spanish priest who said, wolves are in control of the church. Anger ran so high that some collectors for the papal office were hunted down in Germany and put in jail, mutilated, even strangled. The world was moving toward what we call the Renaissance, the birth of a new way of life, but leaders of the church did not recognize that and kept on claiming absolute power over kings and emperors, able to dethrone them, annul their laws, set aside their constitutions. The prestige of the church dipped lower still when for 40 years the papal schism had competing popes, one in France and one in Italy. Half the Christian world held the other half to be heretical, each side claiming that sacraments administered by priests of the opposite side were worthless, that children so baptized and the dying so anointed remained in mortal sin, doomed to hell. Deeply embarrassed, a church council met at the end of the century in Pisa with a call to the Pope in Avignon and the Pope in Rome to make an appearance. They refused. The council said they were illegitimate, and a new pope was elected. Now there were three popes instead of two. With matters so desperate and the expanding world of Islam laughing at Christianity, another council convened at Constance in 1414 and issued a revolutionary decree that this rivalry among popes had to end, that the church had to reform itself, and that if anyone, including the Holy Father himself, refused to obey the council's orders, there would be punishment or worse. The council then accepted the resignation of one pope and deposed the other two, although one of them settled in Spain and went on claiming to be pope until he died at 90. A new pope was chosen, but by then the 3.5-year-long council was exhausted and its original purpose of reforming the church was almost totally lost. The new pope, Martin V, quickly realized that reform could wait, but finances could not, that the huge bureaucratic church had to have more and more money to keep itself in business. There were, through the next century, fine and decent popes who pleaded for less greed and greater innocence in the church, but they were not able to make up for those like Paul II, who wore a crown more costly than a whole palace, like Sixtus IV, who made his nephew a millionaire and who financed his wars by selling church offices to the highest bidder, or like Julius II, who first promoted the sale of something called indulgences in order to build a new St. Peter's in Rome. It was while he was pope that Martin Luther came to Rome and saw abuses so scandalous in his church that he went away doubting it could ever be cleaned up. To make a long and complex story short, the old faith, supreme for centuries, was in deep distress. There were too many competitors who also wanted obedience and who also wanted taxes. The medieval church had fitted in well with feudalism and an agricultural world, but in a time of cities and merchants, manufacturers and financiers, it was suddenly out of step. The best analogy I can think of in modern times is the remarkable collapse of communism in Eastern Europe, when it was hard for us to realize that decades of complaining had changed to action and altered the whole political system in a matter of weeks. It happened like that to the Catholic Church, under siege from kings who wanted to keep their monies at home, from businessmen who wanted full freedom to create the world of capitalism, from ordinary people who began to care more and more about the present and less about the hereafter. As one English author said of their attitude, "He who can get the sweetness of this life and lets it go would be a fool. For no man knoweth whither or by what way we go after death." The power of the church was enormously diminished. It is true that the clergy had scandalized people by immoral conduct, so much so that the great scholar Erasmus, who loved the church and would not leave it, said that many convents of men and women differ little from public brothels. While a papal messenger sent to reform the Benedictine monasteries in France said they gamble, curse, haunt taverns, carry swords, gather riches, fornicate, are more worldly than the most utter worldling. But it was greed, not gluttony or lust, that undid the church. A German parliament claimed that half of the wealth of that country belonged to the church. The French claimed that 3/4 of French wealth belonged to the church. Aeneas Sylvius, before he became pope, wrote that everything was for sale in Rome and that nothing could be had there without money. The monk Savonarola, with perhaps too much spleen, called the church a harlot, ready to sell her favors for a coin. And of all the examples of shameless greed, it was the sale of indulgences that proved the final straw. To explain indulgences, I must explain purgatory for a Protestant church that does not believe in it. Does not believe in it because the New Testament is completely silent about such a place. The doctrine developed later in church history, and in the simplest terms, it goes something like this. If one confessed to venial or mortal sin and then died before the full penance was performed, purgatory became the place of purification or punishment which cleansed the soul and prepared it to enter heaven. It was a kind of second chance, if you will, created, in my view, out of compassion, but vulnerable to exploitation by priests who were greedy or ignorant or both. Vulnerable because there was a way out of suffering in purgatory, a way that worked like this. Many good people had built up merits in excess of any penances due for their sins. And Christ, by his death, the church said, had added an infinity of merits. And these, according to the faith of the times, could be thought of as a treasury on which the Pope could draw to cancel part or all of the penalties not yet paid by the absolved penitents. Penalties like repeating prayers, giving alms, making a pilgrimage, joining a crusade against the infidels, or donating money for roads or hospitals or the church. By making a donation, one might escape a day, a month, or a year in purgatory. One might pay before his death in order to ease his own way, or friends and relatives might give money to diminish the purgatorial suffering of a loved one. Money was also taken for saying masses to reduce a dead soul's term of punishment in purgatory. And driven by love and guilt, those left behind paid handsome sums to the church in somewhat the same way that people now buy a far more expensive casket than they should, lest someone should think they did not love enough. The sums generated by this practice tempted many in the church to corrupt the scheme and make even more money. A class known as pardoners wandered over the country with letters of pardons for sale, a kind of insurance one might buy while still alive. The church never intended this, but in the hands of the unscrupulous, the letter of pardon was represented as a way of paying for your sins even before you committed them. A glass of beer or wine to the pardoner would take care of some small indiscretion. A much larger sum if you had in mind to do Dallas. Good popes condemned these abuses, but up and down the hierarchical line, the lesser clergy took advantage of them. A Catholic historian is very candid about the matter. Indulgences, he writes, took more and more the form of a monetary arrangement. The hawking of indulgences became so shameless in places that the state might have interfered, except that the clergy was exempt from the laws of the state, and church courts could usually be counted on to be lenient to clerical offenders. But contempt for many monks and priests and the church they served hit an all-time high not long before the pent-up explosion we know as the Reformation. In Vienna, for example, the priesthood, once the most desired of all careers, had no recruits at all in the 20 years before the Reformation. Loyal Catholics like Erasmus and John Collett and Thomas More kept hoping that the church would reform itself, and the church did try, often sincerely, but the institution had grown too unwieldy, and the graft had gone on too long, and the bureaucracy was too entrenched. You can understand that, surely, when you consider how hard it is for our own state and national lawmakers to clean up even the obvious abuses, how appeals and windy debates dull the edge of public resentment until people give up in exhaustion and say, "Oh well, that's just how things are," and put up with greed and corruption they detest, but not quite enough. So the church was denounced in every generation by those who hated her and by those who loved her, by the pulpits, by the schools, in the literature of the time, mounting day by day, year after year in resentment, until the dam of reverence and tradition burst and Europe was swept by a religious revolution far more radical and profound than the one we have witnessed so recently in Europe. Thousands of people were involved, but one man's name is synonymous with that revolution: Martin Luther, superhuman in certain strengths, subhuman in some of his faults and failings, a study in fascinating paradox. We'll talk about him next week. Please come back.